primarily you have to shift your perspective to really understand how powerful your emotions are. But then taking a note from Eckhart Tolle, for instance, and saying, then step behind it and observe the emotions fully to recognize that you aren't your emotions, but that the viewer of the emotional process is the actual presence of you, then you're on your way. And I feel like that kind of triumvirate is really important. You know, there's the body, there's the mind, and then there's the awareness of the mind.
Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is Wednesday, August the 22nd. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The number one way that you can support the show and help out and be able to help more people be cured of chronic pain, be healed of chronic illness is to simply just leave an iTunes review, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, but jump over there, spend a minute and a half writing a written review, hitting 5 stars on it. If you like what it is that you hear, it only helps the reach of this podcast be able to get more love, more exposure, everything like that. Okay, so today on the podcast, I interview Michael Galinsky. So in the TMS community, you've probably heard of Michael. He's a filmmaker, but he also co-created the movie about Dr. Sarno and Dr. Sarno's life called All the Rage. Michael's been all over the place. He's been making films for a long time, including Malls Across America, Half Cocked, Radiation, Horns and Halos, Code 33, August in the Empire State Building, Miami Manhunt, Battle for Brooklyn, and of course, All the Rage. He's a filmmaker, and it's a really kind of amazing. I've been connected with him on social media now for close to a year, pretty darn close to a year. I've watched All the Rage probably, I don't know, 8, 10, 12 times, something like that. And I've had the opportunity to kind of follow some of his writings and some of the photography that he does and really just kind of look at the world through his eyes. And it's really been an awesome experience. So we're going to get into that interview in a couple of minutes. But I thought what I would start with, because you know, I interviewed somebody on here recently, Jennifer Hintenberger. She's the kettlebell sports world record holder. And we talked a lot about things that weren't like traditional chronic pain issues that we talk about on this show. You know, we talk a lot about back pain and neck pain and knee pain and things like that. But she got into really the stomach issues of it a lot. And then I started thinking even further outside the box. I've talked about dairy issues on this show, like food intolerances. But something I was thinking about recently. So in the last, I've been taking a daily allergy and asthma medication since 2012. I think it was maybe right around March. It was either March or June of 2012. And it just seemed kind of strange. And it's always seemed kind of strange to me that basically overnight, I suddenly developed these asthma and allergy issues. But now being able to read plenty of people talk about the fact that their allergies and their asthma were brought on by this syndrome, the mind-body syndrome or TMS. I went back and I thought about what Dr. Hanscom said in our podcast that we did together, which was all the way back. It was you know, quite a ways back in the early part of July. But he was talking about the changes in body chemistry. It's episode 25 if you want to go back and reference it. But basically, like changes in body chemistry once you're in that hyper-elevated fight or flight. And I talked in depth. The whole episode last week was about fight or flight in a pep talk that I was giving all the listeners. But basically being in chronic fight or flight, the sympathetic nervous system activation, the body chemistry changes substantially. So maybe slight allergens are things that you shouldn't normally have a reaction to since you're so elevated and since you're so overreactive, your system will then use that. So one really interesting thing that happened, I went out with it. So again, I haven't gone a day without this medicine in 6 years. And then 10 or 12 days ago, I just stopped cold turkey, stopped taking it. I noticed no difference in my allergy and asthma symptoms. In fact, I went and ran a 5K on a whim, and I did it in like 20 minutes and 40 seconds or something like that. And I'm not a runner. I'm a weightlifter, if you follow me on social media. But you know, I went and did that in this smoky-ass Seattle air that we've been having the last little while. And I didn't have any sort of asthma issues, and it was really interesting. And then by Saturday, so I think I had gone 8 days or so without taking it, 8 or 9 days without taking it. And I started to just kind of get my symptoms were coming back. I was a little bit more allergic and asthmatic. And I was going on a date with my wife that night. And I just really wanted to, I didn't want to have to think about this kind of stuff. So I took the meds. And then I woke up Sunday and my back was throbbing, right? So again, like no back issues and asthma. Take away the asthma, take away the allergies by taking the medication, and suddenly the back starts to hurt again. So very, very strange. So what that tells me is that I need to spend a little bit more time sort of doing some internal excavation. I know that something must be bothering me, and it's probably more at the unconscious level, and it's probably not necessarily the things that I'm thinking about, or it could be partially the things that I'm thinking about. You know, again, like physical symptoms most of the time are going to be a manifestation of some kind of underlying anxiety or some kind of underlying emotional stress that you have. So I would say that's probably what it is that's going on. So actually, I popped open and I read a few chapters out of or a few pages out of Nicole Sachs's book, The Meaning of Truth, last night. I can't recommend it enough. You know, go to Amazon, pick it up. It's probably $10 or something like that. Great use of your funds to go and check that out. I love Nicole. She's wonderful. So in any event, the other thing that I wanted to talk about was okay, so way back on an episode that I did with Taylor Gage. This was last year. If I can even, like, I've got my dashboard open here. What was the date on that interview? So I interviewed Taylor Gage way back in November of 2017. It was episode 8. But one of the things that we talked about in that was the idea of the shoulds. And what the shoulds are is really like, I should be doing this. I should be married by this age. I should have kids by this age. I should be this successful in my career. I should be going to the gym right now. I should be doing this. I should be doing that. And I thought about, so feelings and stuff, which is Christy Wiepe and Dan Lyman. They're from the Pain Psychology Center in Beverly Hills, but they've got this YouTube series. And the reason I'm thinking about this is because they're launching the new season. I think it's on the 27, 28, something like that. But they're talking, there's an episode, if you go in there and you talk about it, it's called Feelings and Stuff, Pressure is the topic. And it's from January 25th of 2018. But they get to talking about the shoulds and putting pressure on yourself. And that a lot of times, I see a absolute correlation. When I start getting some ramping up of symptoms, and it could just be a little bit of tightening in the neck or tightening in the back or you know, some more asthma or allergies, a lot of it has to do with what I should be doing right now. I should be selling more. I should be prospecting more. I should be doing this. I should be doing that. When in reality, like, you know, oftentimes it's just a lot easier to kind of just let life flow and not try and dictate life all the time, because there's so many moving pieces and so much variability. You're going to kill yourself by trying to control it. So I'm going to put a link to Feelings and Stuff, this particular episode around the shoulds, in the episode description as well, because one thing I think that Taylor even said, Taylor Gage, in that episode from months ago on the podcast, was fuck the shoulds, was I think what she had actually said. And in a lot of ways, I feel the same way. I think it's so easy for us to kind of get caught in this rabbit hole of, like, we should, you know, again, like, we should have these kind of expectations. And everybody's so obsessed with, like, you know, nose to the grindstone. And there's these books about getting up at 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. and, you know, making sure that you're working 12 hours or 15 hours or whatever the case is, when really, like, you turn around and you're dead. And that's it. Like, if it's something that you truly enjoy, I think that's one thing. If it's just, I'm getting up early for the sake of getting up early because I feel like I should, I feel like that is that's a problem. It's a problem to me personally. And I feel like a lot of people listening to this will kind of resonate in the same way. You know, those batteries can wear out pretty fast, especially if you have, you know, other things going on in your life. You know, you add careers and commutes and car trouble and bills and pets and kids and all that kind of stuff on top of it. It just you know, life gets heavy. That's just the way it is. So any event, let's pick this up. Michael Galinsky, from Rumor. So Rumor Films, that's the studio that he owns to put out documentaries and put out different movies. He kind of goes through this whole process of, not only seeing Dr. Sarno, but talking about Dr. Sarno, what ultimately led him to being healed and being pain-free. But in my mind, I think that the biggest and coolest part of this episode is when Michael starts to talk about this very important distinction and why he doesn't call this syndrome TMS. He doesn't call it tension myositis syndrome, doesn't call it tension myoneural syndrome. He doesn't even call it the mind-body syndrome. What he subscribes to is that it's called basically the condition of being human. That we kind of all feel these things, and people express it in different ways. Some people get anxiety. Some people have skin problems. Some people get back pain. Some people get neck pain. It's a subtle, but it's a very important distinction. Here's Michael Galinsky. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. This week, big treat. I've talked about this movie, All the Rage, about Dr. Sarno for months and months and months, but I've got the filmmaker and director, Michael Galinsky, on the line with me. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks so much for joining me today. I've had some conversations with you over the last several months, and you know how much of a fan I am of the movie. I remember there was, I feel like maybe there was some copy that was done on it, but the narrative was, have you ever watched a movie that has changed your life? And I remember the first time I watched it, which was it was a Vimeo rental, and then eventually I kept renting it, right? And so at the very end, you know, I showed it to my wife, and my wife, like, she doesn't have the past and the story and the connection to Sarno and to you that I do. But she saw me and how moved I was at the end, right? Like, Sarno gets the book and it's all these thank yous and stuff. But I want to start back. Like, you're a filmmaker. You know, Dr. Sarno's not the only thing that defines you. It's the way that I came across you, but right. Tell me about your history, how you got into film, how long you've been doing this, you know, things like that.
Well, I wanted to clarify one thing at the beginning. You know, I'm one of the people who made this film. There were three of us who made it together, and we've been making films together for 20 years as Rumor. But I first started making films with my wife, Suki, back in 1994, and that's how I kind of got into film. But before that, I was a photographer and a musician, and so we ended up making a movie called Half Cocked, which is about documenting that world that I was a part of and taking pictures of. She was in film school at the time, and I talked her into dropping out to make the movie with me.
And where are you originally from, and where did you guys meet?
Well, I'm originally from North Carolina, which is where we live again now, but I went to college in New York, and I stayed there for almost 30 years. And I recently moved home.
And is that how, I mean, it's probably your most well-known piece, but were you living in Brooklyn at the time that you were filming Battle for Brooklyn, or was that just a coincidence?
Oh, no, that's how it was. I mean, you have young kids. I had young kids then. And basically what happened was there was this arena that was announced. They were going to build this Garden of Eden in Brooklyn. But our kid went to daycare like two blocks from where this thing was announced, and people lived there. I didn't know what they were talking about. Like, what do you mean this Garden of Eden grows out of nothing? So I started asking around, and it turned out that there were people starting to fight, and there was a sign that said, stop the arena. So I called up the number just to find out what their concerns were, and that afternoon I was shooting. And what made it possible was I would drop off my kid at daycare and walk down the street and start shooting. Because, you know, we started doing a bunch of things in that area because we couldn't run all over the country, couldn't run all around because you had kids. So it was very much a local story, but was also very related to everything that was going on about living in a certain place.
Well, and that story is about what eventually became the Barclay Center, right?
Exactly, right. And it's interesting because it's so connected, you know. When we moved to North Carolina, we did so partly to finish All the Rage. But before that, we finished another movie called Who Took Johnny, and we started working on another movie called Working on Protest. But really what I wanted to do when I got here was kind of like take stock of what we've done and start to make sense of it. So for me, this is an easy conversation. But, you know, one of the things was it's about kind of a shifting sense of what documentation means. Like when we made Half Cocked, we actually didn't feel like we could make a documentary because we were part of that community. And it felt like you had to have, quote, critical distance in order to make a documentary about something.
Yep.
And now I've come to believe exactly the opposite, that unless you are somehow engaged and in part of a community, you really don't have the standing to be the one passing judgment on it.
It reminds me a lot of, I used to work with a lot of firefighters and police officers in previous jobs. And one thing that I always found really interesting is that a lot of them don't like living in the area that they serve and in police protect right. and serve. And I always thought that was really interesting because I felt like you're going to have far more, and maybe this is or is not true, but to me, it felt like you're always going to have a much more vested interest in protecting and serving the land that you live. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's also more empathy. So I mean, in New York, that's a huge problem. Like, you know, the cops in Brooklyn all live in Rockland County, and so they're basically an occupying force, and they look upon the people that they're supposed to be protecting and serving, many of them, as kind of subjects rather than community members. And that's where we have so much division between different groups of people.
Well, a lot of the scenes in the trailer for Battle for Brooklyn remind me a lot of, like, think like Los Angeles County, you know, the Rodney King riots when the police officers were acquitted of everything. That's a lot of what that reminded me of when I was watching some of the clips there. And the thing is, like, I couldn't be further from New York in the U.S., right? Like, I live in Seattle, so that wasn't a news story here. But maybe we have something like similar that's been brewing here that eventually was turned down and isn't going to happen. But they were talking about like vacation of streets and eliminating some of the commercial district down here to build a basketball arena to have the Supersonics eventually return. And there was debate over which town, like there was a local ownership guy or group who bought the Sacramento Kings, and then the transaction was voided, and so the arena didn't get built, and then Seattle eventually turned down the vacation of some of those commercial and businesses. But the difference, I think, in this versus that is that there was no housing in Seattle where this was going to happen.
Right. But the housing here was just a Trojan horse. It's still not built. Very little of it is built, and it was all about public. The interesting thing about Battle for Brooklyn, and it's actually very connected to the story, and I'm going to roll back a little bit, but we were making a film after we made the two, we made two narrative features because we didn't think we, you know, could really make documentaries about things we were a part of. Then we made a documentary about a guy who republished a discredited biography of George Bush in 2000. And, you know, that was a really interesting process, and we learned a lot about making documentaries, and we started making documentaries. But the point is, the movie was really, we were very happy with it. It was a really good movie, but it was a movie that wasn't really an anti-Bush movie, but it was a hard look at politics. Our last day of shooting was September 10th, 2001.
Oh, wow. So
the next year was just impossible. No one wanted to hear anything about it. It was seen as such a threat. Literally, a year later, it got invited to the Toronto Film Festival, which was kind of a big deal. And we didn't even submit it. They just seen it at a smaller festival and said, you know what, this didn't get the attention deserved. And it was also on the anniversary of the second anniversary of September 11. Or the first anniversary, actually. It was 2002 when we were showing it. The crazy thing is, we then needed a publicist. So we sent copies to every publicist in L.A., which is where all the publicists were. And they all got them in plastic bags saying this has been opened by the government.
Oh man.
It was really weird. It was like, how the hell did they even stop them? I mean, how did they find them? You know, that was really terrifying to just see how deep those things can go sometimes. And no publicist would represent it until finally one guy did. But the movie eventually got shortlisted for the Academy Award, and we distributed it and everything else. But the frustration around that whole process and having it kind of ignored is what led to me being stuck on the floor the first time.
Yeah, yeah, and we're going to well, that's obviously going to be the big chunk of kind of what this is about. Selfishly, though, I do have one other question about one of the other projects, and simply because my wife is obsessed with true crime stories, and so when I saw that you co-directed Miami Manhunt and then went and watched the trailer for that, is that something that I could even still find if I wanted to go? Like,
it's, you know what? It's on Canopy, and it's also on Vimeo On Demand. You know what? That's another frustration. So, actually, what happened was, with my leg going out that first time, I was working on Miami Manhunt with a 1.5-year-old at home, totally stressed out, and also dealing with the distribution of Horns and Halos. And I hurt my leg in a pickup basketball game in Miami while on that shoot. And that's when I'd started to deteriorate. And then we were starting Battle for Brooklyn as well. And that's when it just got worse and worse and worse and worse until I ended up on the floor screaming in total insane pain. So there, all these things are connected. And then I went to see Dr. Sarno and got better, you know, not 100%, but I started to get better. And that's when we started making the movie, and we couldn't make it. And then after Battle for Brooklyn, when the movie was, we were so proud of it, got great reviews, no one would show it. We were never able to sell it. That's when I ended up, you know, on the floor screaming in pain the second time.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that I was just noticing that trend. It's just this kind of like this when feeling not listened to, and you have this really important information that people need to know, and it's just ignored because it doesn't fit with the overriding paradigm. The willful blindness that it faces is kind of crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so normally, like when I do this podcast, I sort of Tarantino it, and we kind of start at the end. Okay, you found the resolution, and then we almost work backwards. But because of what you just said, this trend of not
did I screw it up?
No, not at all, not at all. I think it might be better this way. So you said this trend essentially of not being listened to and sort of overlooked. I think that the story of your parents that you tell in the movie is super fascinating, because although that my parents weren't in psychotherapy like yours were, my parents were both teachers, and so I, you know, like two parents doing essentially the same or very, very similar jobs, we have that similarity. The mm-hmm. time when our pain really started to become big started around the same time, right? You, like, you have kids, you have a lot of these different projects yeah. going on. So tell me about, like, as a kid, like, I guess when you think, now that you have all these years to look back, which, by the way, I looked and saw how old you were, and you look amazing for your age, right? you know, but more is okay. So is the birth year true? 1969? Is that right?
Yeah.
I've started to decide that I have just zero concept of what over the age of 40 even looks like. Maybe it's because I see my dad, he's going to be 68 in a couple of weeks, and I see my 40-year-old dad. I don't see a 68-year-old right. man. So right. you know, maybe that's part of it. But now that you have all these years to look back, I guess, like, tell me early on, like, there had to be some kind of symptomatology or something that you had as a kid that now you can look back and say, yeah, this was those types of symptoms or maybe the breeding ground for you know, my symptoms go back this far. What were they maybe as a kid? Was there anything you can point to?
So I have a twin brother, and I would say he had this problem before me and worse than I did in some ways. But he had a lot of symptomology. I don't know that I did. That I was aware of. I wasn't really sick very much. Basically, in my early 20s, my back would start to go out like once or twice a year for 2 or 3 days, and I would get better. And it was at that point that my brother wasn't able to use his hands, and literally was so bad, he almost dropped out of graduate school. But I think part of that had to do with, I really did follow what I wanted to do, even though that was difficult. Like, I knew I wanted to make images, and I did it. I knew I wanted to go to college just to go to college and learn. I didn't want to follow a path. And I did it. And those things are hard to do when people are telling you, hey, you need to follow this right path or you're going to be screwed. You're never going to find a job and all this stuff. But I did what I felt like I needed to do. So I think in some ways that helped me
yep.
to kind of listen to myself, even though other people weren't listening to me. So if anything, what I had was more self-doubt and anxiety than physical symptoms. But I did, my back would go out now and then. And when my brother went to see Dr. Sarno and got better, after my dad had gone to see Dr. Sarno or read his book and gotten better, that's when I read his book when I was like 22. And when I read it, it really made sense to me. And for the next 10 years, every time I have like a little sense or like I wake up with a really stiff back, I could make it go away. It was only when I had a one-year-old, two movies, no hope of ever making any money, that the weight started to crush down on me.
Yeah, and so there's a scene in All the Rage. So I might have had, so I interviewed Nicole Sachs, who's a psychotherapist out of, I think she's in Delaware or something, but mm-hmm. I know that she ended up being one of the psychotherapists or LCSWs that Sarno would refer patients to. And I feel like she may have been evaluated by him. I would have to go back.
She did. She went to see him. She was in a terrible place and had gone to see him, and that's what got her better and on the path to be a therapist.
Gotcha. Okay. So she had spondylolisthesis, and she would say that like the bottom of her spine on X-ray looked like Swiss cheese and stuff like that. Yeah. I think it's really timely that there's a scene in All the Rage. You're being evaluated. You're one of two people that I've had the pleasure of talking to that's actually gone through a physical evaluation of him. But he says, what did they tell you was the reason for your pain? You talk about L4 of L5 disc protrusion. I got a text from a friend of mine last night whose husband's been in totally aggravated pain for several weeks. And I said, okay, well, what did they tell him was the reason? This is an exact text. She said, it's a protrusion at L4, L5 and a small herniation at L5, S1. It'll be a really long road. And I go, my podcast tomorrow is with a spine surgeon. His exact quote is, there's zero reason that disc herniations cause back pain. And I said, and furthermore, I'm talking to a guy who had a disc protrusion as well, and I'll talk to him about it. So Tell me about some of your symptoms, why they didn't line up with this L4, L5 disprotrusion theory.
Well, frankly, in some sense, they did. Like, that's where the really bad pain was. But as he pointed out, you have pain over here, you have pain over here, you have tightness here. It doesn't really make sense. And so that did make it a little harder for me. But at the same time, the doubt wasn't real doubt. It was just resistance to going deeper. So a lot of times people think I doubt this thing. But it's really like, to not doubt it means that you have to turn towards it. And people don't want to do that, And so that it can be very, very difficult. So when I look at even that scene, so for instance, we actually shot that a year after I'd gone to see him because we were trying to figure out how to make this movie. I didn't want to be in it. I definitely didn't want to be in it. But we literally couldn't find anyone to go see him because he wouldn't make any accommodations, i.e. he wouldn't see somebody who wasn't paying the full rate because he thought that would be not fair. And we also, as documentarians, couldn't pay for someone else to go. So we were just having this really hard time figuring out how to do it. So I said, look, let's just film him talking to me. But when I actually went in to see him, I was such a mess. I think I had to get in a wheelchair to get down the hall to go see him.
Yeah.
We have this other person in the movie who's not in the movie, actually, but a doctor whose name is escaping me at the moment, but he's based in Atlanta. He's a psychiatrist who I filmed speaking with Dr. Sarno to, increase his practice. And Dr. Sarno says to him, so how did you come to talk to me? He goes, well, when I was about 10, my dad carried my mother in to see you. She hadn't walked in a year, and she walked out of your office. So in our family, you're a hero. But when this guy was finishing graduate school, like literally in his last week of, grad medical school, someone was falling off a gurney and he reached down to help him and his back went out. And he had a year of terrible pain. And his dad kept saying, you know what this is. And finally he called Dr. Sarno and he got better. But it took, and his doctor, he didn't fully believe it because he'd just been indoctrinated in the medical theory for 6 years. So to hear it was just almost impossible to believe. But once he found out it was true, he's incorporated in his practice. I mean, the mind is so incredibly powerful in its ability to kind of almost stand like a pier in the ocean, like just unmoving, even though these waves of truth are hitting it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and even like the methods of getting better, it seemed like, because I didn't read Mind Over Back Pain, the very first one he wrote in the mid-80s or whenever it was that it came out, but yeah. I read the following three. So I read Healing Back Pain, the Mind-Body Prescription, and the Divided Mind. And it seemed like over time, so the Mind-Body Prescription came out in 1999. And I don't feel like in Healing Back Pain there was any mention of the anecdote. Like aside from knowledge, there wasn't like a, you should go journal, you should do this. But then he started talking in the Mind-Body Prescription, make a list of the things that are upsetting you and that kind of thing. And you talk about, it seemed like where there's actually a scene in the movie there. I think it's one of your daughters is like shaking the snow off a tree. And to me, the way that I interpret that, I don't know if this is the imagery that you were going for, but it's almost like, okay, now like we're shaking these loose ends off of my, off of my personal tree. And now I'm really going to start accelerating the healing process. And you get into talking about, you start talking about your dad passing away and then you burst into tears. And then you talk about meditation and getting more into journaling. What was your, like, what was your journaling practice like? And what was your meditation practice like?
Well, I've always been someone who journaled, as much as kind of like taking notes on what's going on in my life so that I could remember it later. And in fact, when my daughter was very little, I started a journal for her, just telling her what was going on and what struggles we were dealing with so that she might be able to remember them later to be able to deal with them. So I've always been something of a journaler, but I'm not great at it, but I do it and I make myself do it now. So my first practice when I first started getting better was mostly journaling. And it took me several years before I started really focusing on meditation because I really found it so difficult to do. Even though when I'd say in my early 20s, I was interested in it because I was a religious studies major in college. Not because it was like, I want to be a graduate student in religious studies. It was time to declare my major and I realized I'd completed it.
Oh, okay. How can I get out of here faster?
And I did. I got out a semester early. It was like time to sign up for my last semester. And I was like, oh, I'm done. And it's not that I wanted to get out of there so early as much as I just didn't. I felt like I'd done what I needed to do. I enjoyed college, and I'd like to still be in college, actually. I like learning.
Yeah.
But I lost my train of thought there. But the religious studies aspect. So I was always really interested in religion because I didn't grow up with kind of a spiritual background. You know, we were non-religious Jews. And when I look back, you know, you can really understand why there's such a strong spark towards atheism in the culture that grew up after the war. There was just so much trauma, and so much of it was related to religion.
Yep.
You can understand why people would want to turn their back on that. But for me, I was always interested in connecting to that, yet still having a lot of skepticism about it, because that's also a learned behavior. So it took me a long time to go to that place of really concentrating on meditation. And it actually happened when I went to go get a book in the library by a neighbor here named Dr. Norton Hadler, who wrote a book called Stabbed in the Back, which has all the science that proves that the medicalization of back pain is the main problem in our medical culture, and the medicalization of just normal bodily functioning. But he was also my father's doctor.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about you saying that is that the doctor, Dr. David Hanscom, is a pretty well-known spine surgeon in Seattle at the Swedish Medical Institute and all of that. And one of the quotes that he gave me that was such a great nugget when I interviewed him was that there are over 1,000 studies on there's over 1,000 studies that have been done that show expressive writing as relieving chronic pain. And he goes, you know how many have been done, or you know how many studies there are that back surgery is the cure for chronic back pain. And I was like, how many? And he said, none. And so I thought that was really interesting, is that it's almost like, and Nicole Sachs talks about, I mean, this is her bread and butter, this journal speak idea. And the thing that those two have in common, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts on this, is the idea of writing something and then destroying it, you know, burning it up, whatever. Because you had talked about like keeping a journal to remember your thoughts or remember some instances. So are these things that you keep, or have you evolved that over time?
Oh, I still write in these journals in the same way. I use those black books and I just fill them because they also have keepsakes and stuff. And I rarely go back and look at them. The point is more as an artist rather than as a treatment method.
Yeah.
Those are things that I like. I have drawings in and stuff like that. But I think that that letting it go is important. But it's interesting because I had an interesting back and forth with someone on the Facebook page the other day, because I very quickly posted an article about the vagus nerve that someone was saying is connected to everything. And this person was very upset, saying, listen, these things are really dangerous. It makes people think it's physical. But when I quickly skimmed it, what I was seeing was tons of data that shows how the emotions spark the vagus nerve to have this reaction, and how we need to figure out how to calm our stuff. So I was trying to talk about it with this person, but she was very, very adamant that meditation was like exercise, that people shouldn't do it if they think it's going to cure them. And it was this really weird conversation, because I wasn't making that argument. I was making the argument that meditation is a really important process in terms of calming our physical systems, right? I think those things are all connected. I think that there's a really important recognition that we have to think emotionally rather than physically. But at a certain point, I think you shift to going, oh, let me think about what's going on physically so I can understand what's going on emotionally better, and finding that balance between the two.
Well, and I think that sometimes one thing that I've gathered in this 13-month odyssey of my own is I've been, you know, I went from pure physical treatments and thousands of dollars of it to then reading the Sarno stuff and then going 100% cold turkey, which, you know, I think was the right frame of mind. It got me within a day of reading Sarno's book, I was probably 70% better, which is what gave me the greatest indication that, you know, going to see another chiropractor is not going to help me. It's just not, you know, going to get an injection, whatever, is just not going to be the solution. But as I've read more books and interviewed guys like Dr. David Hanscom, like I think that there is a place for, and even Steve Ozanich had turned a corner by the time his second book came out, because at first I think he was very much hardlined, where he said, hardline is a weird way to describe that, but nevertheless, hard-headed on the thought that anything that you do intentionally is going to delay healing. But then there's a section in the second book where he says, Look, if somebody were to ask me right now, what can I do to get out of pain the fastest? And he talks about conscious breathing, you know, diaphragmatic breathing. And diaphragmatic breathing and the vagus nerve have a big correlation because they essentially the vagus nerve is activating the parasympathetic nervous system, which is what, I mean, that's what we want, right? Like we're locked in, you spent years, right? Like you're locked in fight or flight, which is the sympathetic nervous system. You want to get to rest and digest, which is parasympathetic nervous system. And there have been people for years, I mean, Buddhism goes back a long time, and they always talked about meditation, and here's the reasons why. So I feel like around the world, a lot of people are saying exactly the same thing, but it's almost like they're, you know, we all want to heal. We all have these same problems. We have different people that we follow, but it just seems like the beliefs and how you get there is not in alignment, even though people are using these different methods and finding 100% results on all different kinds of things.
I think that, so I would go back to, I think that what we're searching for is a balance between the physical and the emotional. The problem is the emotional is the terror. It is the one. It is the ego that's in control. So unless there's an awareness of that and a being with it, I think it's much harder to find healing. So as much as we can do these physical things, and the interesting thing is, say, the breath is really both the emotional and the physical. Of all things, that's why we always talk about the breath. I think he's right. Like you want to do the deep breathing so you can bring some calmness to the system, so that then you can activate the mind. It's funny, I was in a band, and in our first single, I had the artist who did the cover write, confusing the body to exploit the mind, you know, which is really about, like, just trying to create a space where the body isn't taking control over the mind, and the mind isn't taking control over the body, but so that we can be present with what we're really thinking and feeling. And all of this is kind of obtuse, and I want to get back to the very simple point I was trying to make, was that Dr. Sarno was right, I believe, in saying awareness of the power of the emotions is primary. And until we fully understand that, and that helps us reshift our perspective, there's a lot of problems in getting over it, right? So all the physical things that you can do, including the breathing and the meditation and the yoga, without combining that chocolate with the peanut butter of awareness, you're not going to get that Reese's peanut butter cup. You know what I mean? It's like you're going to have these two distinct things, and you really need the fullness of both understandings. But I think that primarily you have to shift your perspective to really understand how powerful your emotions are. But then taking a note from Eckhart Tolle, for instance, and saying, then step behind it and observe the emotions fully, to recognize that you aren't your emotions, but that the viewer of the emotional process is the actual presence of you, then you're on your way. And I feel like that kind of triumvirate is really important. You know, there's the body, there's the mind, and then there's the awareness of the mind.
Certainly. And actually, I'm glad that you brought up Eckhart Tolle, because after you talked about him in your movie, I went and bought his book, like right after I saw that you mentioned it the first time. And you had said that, like, this, you know, this process of going from pain to healed took kind of a spiritual turn. And then you talk about Eckhart Tolle, and then you went and talked to Prince, and you know, a lot of this, like, it comes back to me where it's like all these people are saying a lot of the same stuff. It's just we're saying it in different ways.
And it's about, and I think, like, even so, there's a very particular reason that the last line of the film is, it all comes down to one very simple idea, that the mind and the body are intimately connected. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That's the whole story. And that's why I posted that article about the vagus nerve, because the vagus nerve is what connects it all.
Yep.
And so, like, I don't see any difference myself between someone who is in back pain and someone who has chronic fatigue. It's all that same thing. I like to think about it like this. Like, say your body is kind of like a Roman fort, or, you know, in the English countryside, right? There's this fort, and it's got the fort door, and when things are calm, the produce is coming in and the garbage is going out. Now someone attacks the fort, right? The door goes down, resources start to dwindle, and waste starts to pile up, right? at a certain point, you know, if you look over the side of the wall, you'll see that the people have left, but then maybe, you know, the attackers have left because they weren't able to breach the fortress, right? But if you don't open the door, the waste still piles up, right? And so that's the parasympathetic sympathetic. So if we go into that fight or flight and we don't stop, you're like someone who's in the fortress and the waste just piles up and piles up and it's toxic.
Right.
That's what autoimmune issues are. If you are constantly in fight or flight, you're going to have autoimmune issues.
So the autoimmune thing is interesting, and it's actually, I went back before I posted the interview with Dr. Hanscom. I caught it when we were doing the conversation, but going back and re-listening to him talk about autoimmune disease and how that is it's the result of elevated adrenaline, elevated stress, elevated cortisol, and when you balance out that system, the autoimmune disease goes away. And like, I feel like there's a number of people in my life that I know that have autoimmune diseases, and I may bunch in celiac with that because it depends on who you're talking to. They may put that in the same category or not, but right. A lot of people would dispute that. But I know for me personally, this is 3-4 weeks ago now at this point where I've had dairy issues, being my body being able to just handle dairy. I would have terrible stomach problems, and it for me it happened within a few days. Like, I went from being able to have, like, you know, ice cream and cheese and all the stuff that I love all the time to not being able to have any of it without just feeling miserable. And I was reading something that Nicole Sachs had written, and she had talked about this client of hers whose husband was coming up. They'd been married for 40 years. He was coming up for retirement, and everybody was kind of praising him and stuff. And some of the things that her client was sharing with her is, you know, why is everybody, you know, everybody praising this guy? I stayed home. I raised the kids by myself. I didn't get any help from him. And she started having IBS, stomach problems, you know, constipation issues, allergic to things she wasn't ever previously to. And I texted Nicole after I read that, and I go, you know, when I went back and looked at when I, because I, you know, I'm a terrible TMSer in the fact that I document everything. I'm getting away from that, which is good. But I went back and looked, and within a week, 8 days of me having these dairy problems, we found out that we were pregnant with Zoe, with our youngest daughter, or with our oldest daughter. So, and that was sort of the beginning of this cascade of hell, you know, tendonitis and acid reflux and all sorts of different problems as the years went on. And I texted her and told her, I think that maybe my dairy issue has been solved. And last week I'm putting some chips on a plate. My wife walks down the stairs and I'm literally like dropping cheese on top of it, like getting ready to make nachos. And she's like, you're just going to go for it, huh? And I'm like, it's the only way I'll ever know. Right. Like, it's the only way I'll ever know. And I feel nothing. I don't feel the symptoms that I had before, which, like, right. It's not autoimmune, but it's a stomach issue, and it's the body attacking itself in a certain way. So I'm glad that you brought that particular thing up. Are you, like, now that you've gone through this whole experience, I mean, do you armchair quarterback at all people that you know in your life now or have known throughout time where you're like, yep, that person had TMS. Yep, that person has TMS. Like, do you do
that? I actually don't really ever use it. We actually had kind of a conflict. I didn't want to put TMS in the movie in a way, because, you know, when you make something, it's part of a cultural moment, but it's going to be there forever. And I feel like TMS can be problematic in the sense that people then hold on to it. I call it just the disease of being human.
Yep.
You know, that person has humanness, which means that they hold things in their body. So I was just making that comment, but yes and no. Yes, it's also hard too, because you know, I've learned over time who's going to listen and who's not, and you know, a lot of times people don't want to hear it. So I'm certainly not, you know, it's what Dr. Sklar says in the film, which is that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, and that doesn't mean that the teacher is going to show up when the student is ready. The teacher is always there. It's just when the student's ready to hear what that is. Like, that you know so many people who said, oh yeah, like, I read that book and I thought it was bullshit, and then I read it 4 years later and I was like, oh my God, it's so true. You know, it's interesting. We watched the movie Network the other night, and it's so prescient in terms of media and reality TV. I mean, it's probably 50 years old now, and it predicted everything. Yeah. And I've seen it 10 or 15 times over the years, but watching it the other night, it was like, oh my God, it's even better than you could have imagined. It gets better all the time. And those things that are just observant of things are like that. So going back, I don't know if we talked about it on this discussion yet, but you know, the very first project I did was taking pictures in malls in 1989. And at the time that I took it, and this is connected, don't worry, I'm going to bring it back together. I took those pictures. I was taking them in a really open, non-judgmental way, and not really kind of, and I was in between being an amateur and I wasn't really a professional, but I was more than an amateur. And so when I showed them to people, they're like, oh yeah, these are cool. Those are people in malls. Who gives a crap? 30 years later, because they are so of that moment, and they're not like photographs from that moment. They just feel like that moment. They have an incredible impact on people. And so in a way, what I'm getting back to, circling back, is this idea of there's certain kind of ideas that are of the moment. And then when you look back at them, they seem so obvious. Like, we tried to make a film that would communicate with people on an emotional level. And we found a lot of resistance to that for people who aren't ready for the teacher, and other people it has a really profound impact on. I think in 5 years, the movie's going to seem so obvious as to be ridiculous, right? Everyone's going to be like, of course, we all know this. This is stupid. Who cares about this? Because in 5 or 10 years from now, everybody's going to know this, and then the movie's going to seem silly.
So
we struggled with finding that balance of, like, that's where I was saying, if you know, even putting the term TMS in it, it's going to seem even more outdated later.
Yeah, well, I mean, even just in the few years between Sarno's most popular book and Sarno's last book, I mean, he even changed TMS remained the acronym, but he changed it from myositis to myoneural. And then since, it seems like Schubiner and Ozanich, you know, they're calling it more the mind-body syndrome now, which seems like that's one of those terms that could last the test of time. I don't know if there's a better way to describe it than that.
No, I think it's true. I just say for myself, something about it, it feels like an attachment.
Yeah.
People call everything TMS because we want a label. We want a diagnosis. But the real diagnosis is, oh, honey, I'm so sorry, but you're human. You know, you're going to have reactions to things and things. And this is where, talking further about meditation, I Dr. Sklar, once again, really insisted that I do the 10-week presence process program. It's a book by Michael Brown. And he told me, and I said, yeah, I'm going to do it. And I actually even ordered the book, but didn't have time to do it. And finally, when I did it, it was so profoundly powerful. It's like, oh yeah, I wasn't ready though. But when I was ready, it really had an incredible impact. And the most important impact it had goes back to what I was just saying with react. We're human and we react. But when we become aware of our reactions, then we can become, as Dr. Matte says, response able. Doesn't mean we're responsible for everything, but if we're able to understand it, then we're able to respond rather than react. And the more you practice that, like if you get mad at somebody, you have to own the fact that that's really about your own judgmental framing of the world, how someone's supposed to act, and they're breaking that pact that you think that everybody is supposed to have, that understanding. So you're angry with them, but really the anger comes with unresolved feelings that you then have to be responsible for. Like, you can say what you just did is not acceptable behavior, but if it comes with a negative energy attached to it, then you're going to get a negative reaction. So the more we're able to, we can address problems, but if we address them without a negative attachment, you get so much better results. So much better. It's crazy, even.
Yeah, I mean, like, kind of what I think sort of led me into, like, my own personal abyss, because the adverse childhood experiences study, you talked about, that was in the movie, but, and we know that Dr. Hanscom talked a lot about this too, but people that score high on that test are probably more likely to have physical symptoms. They're more likely to die 20 years sooner. They're, you know, like, there's a whole lot of data that's out there for that. I was incredibly low on that. I had, you know, a 2 or something like that. And so I don't fit the criteria for that build. However, kind of probably what was going on with me was like this desire to be really, really good in everything that I did. And then hearing that this baby's coming and then maybe it's going to make me deficient in other areas. Will I be a good father? They got all this new stress that's going to come up. But I've always been the guy that just, you know, keep your shit together and do your job and you'll be fine. And when really it's just like the, you know, the weight of the world. And then eventually, like, you know, the the storm comes and then everything starts breaking down and you suddenly just think that you've acquired something, like, or that you have terrible luck because now your elbows are like you see me on social media. I post stuff about weightlifting and doing all that. Like, that was my life before right. I started getting a lot of symptoms, was lifting weights and competing in a sport. And then my symptoms took that away from me, which then elevated my anger, which then elevated my fear that I'm 30 and then I'm not going to be able to do any of this stuff. And I imagine myself, you know, still being active at 60 and 70, and it all kind of fed into it. If I could have just stopped and played Buddha for a second and just watched the lily pad floating down the river and observe it, as opposed to saying that lily pad doesn't exist, I think those symptoms
or saying, happen. Oh my God, that lily pad's going to go over there.
Yeah. And I try and really now, I just feel it's a very, I was thinking this morning, it's so tough for me to describe. I'm gonna do the best way that I can with it because I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. And if you feel the same way, when you think about when your pain was the worst, you're on the floor, everything like that. Like, I remember when I was kind of at my worst and every little thing not set me off in the sense that I would yell and scream and kick, because that was what I wasn't doing. I wasn't feeling, I was almost numb to that. But I remember just feeling almost animalistic on the inside about every negative possible thing. Like, everything is just trigger, trigger, trigger. Like, that's what's happening all the time. And now it still happens, but that is, it's very, stuff that used to bother me for 5 or 6 days may last 10 minutes or something now. And most of the stuff, I'm just not taking as much of it as seriously. And I don't feel that almost inner demon, if you will, bubbling up to the surface. I don't feel it anymore. And I don't know, it's, again, hard to explain, but does that make sense? Do you have kind of a similar experience in maybe how you felt about everything when you were at your worst versus how you feel at about every little thing now?
Oh, totally. Although, I'm also human, and sometimes, like right now, it's been a tough few weeks. I can't really get much done. It's partly what's going on politically, but it's also that, it is still a little frustrating. I keep waiting for this thing to work because I know that the movie is powerful and it has a really profound effect on people, but I can't get it to anybody because I can't get anyone to write about it. Right. So people don't know about it. And so there's this kind of, I'm trying to balance out that sense of frustration with just being present with it, but I still struggle with that. But the difference is so after Horns and Halos end up on the floor, after Battle for Brooklyn end up on the floor, after Who Took Johnny, I would have ended up on the floor, but I was doing this work. And then we finished All the Rage, and it's been even crazier resistance. And, I'm fine, essentially. I'm not having any major problems. But it is frustrating. Yeah. And I just have to, I'm able to respond to that rather than react to it.
So it took, it took 10 years to get that's what the Kickstarter campaign talked about. It took 10 years to get the project done. I guess what what are a lot of the starts and stops in there? I mean, I know you had to find a character, which ended up being you.
Yeah. There was one start and stop, really. So we were trying to get it off the ground from 2004 to 2006. We applied for 30 grants. Nobody would fund it. We had no way to do it. We had a kid. We couldn't really work on a film full time that we needed to with no funding because we had a kid and then we had another kid. And I didn't also really know how to make it because we typically made films where you follow a character, and Dr. Sarner really just didn't want to be that character. A character, just by the definition of storytelling, a character has to be someone who is facing conflict. But he didn't want to have any conflict. He was conflict avoidant, so there was no story.
Right.
And so that's where it just kind of fell to the wayside. And that was a heavy weight, too, because I felt responsible to make this movie, but I didn't know how to do it. So then when it happened again, that was in 2011. And then it was pretty much full time for the next 5 years. And that's pretty much all I worked on.
Yeah. And when did it finally finish? When did you wrap filming, and then when was it done? We're shipping this out. It's finished. It's edited.
Well, showed it. We were trying to get it into one of the major festivals like Sundance, because that's the way you get press. But we didn't, or Toronto, and we finally, we submitted to Toronto, and the guy who was the programmer there didn't watch it until it was already programmed, but then he invited it to this other festival in New York called Doc NYC, which we decided to do because Dr. Sarno was there and he could come see it. So that was in November of 2016. And then it took 5 months for us to get it in another festival, which was a small festival in Montana. And then we got into Argentina, and then, you know, we slowly started getting into some other festivals, but it was really, it was tough. And then we put it in theaters ourselves, in the spring of 2017. And even though we did really well in New York, we couldn't get anyone else to book it. It's just been a really, it's been tough. And, yeah. And you know, the press reviews, the film reviews were a little bit, it didn't do what they wanted it to do, and they didn't think it made sense for me to be in it, but they also didn't understand that that's the way to connect with the audience. And so that's a little frustrating as well.
Yeah. I mean, I read the reviews, I wrote my own on IMDb, and, I thought that a lot of those weren't exactly fair either. And I also feel the sense that I got as I'm reading some of these is I'm like, you haven't felt this. That's why, like, you know, you haven't had, like, because somebody that's
pissed at being asked to feel it. So if you're a film reviewer or a critic, it means you're judgmental and critical. That's why you're a reviewer.
Right.
And so the film actually kind of unconsciously forces you to confront what you really feel. And it's much easier to go, oh my God, that's so annoying. That guy is so annoying. So the movie is about how our culture shames us for being emotionally present. So if you're emotionally present, you say, I feel sad. Oh, get over it, right, et cetera. So the very fact that all of the reviews shame me for being in the movie because I'm being emotionally present in the movie.
Which just seems, I think that maybe the reviewers think that it's the same as if, like, Michael Jordan coaches an NBA team and then puts himself in the starting five.
I think it's really more just that they're like, it's just easy to say that guy's so annoying and so full of himself, so narcissistic, when, you know, that was a fear of doing it. And in fact, after the first screenings, people are like, oh, that was so brave of you. And I'm like, what's so brave? I'm just in the movie. It's like an art movie. That's what people do in movies, right? And then I was like, oh, when people responded to it, then I started to see that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know how I feel. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Right, which is why we're talking about this in this way. And, you know, even there's an even danger in complaining about it because we're also not allowed to point out things that are upsetting, right, in our culture. So it's like to even complain about those reviews is not allowed. So there's actually no even forum for asking those hard questions about it. But like you said, you know, on IMDb, there's 112 reviews, and 100 of them are, you know, explain how the movie changed their lives.
Yeah.
And that was intentional. We did 65 screenings in our house, and each screening pushed it more and more towards the personal and less towards the data, because the data only raised more questions, right? Like, and then it made people feel like you're trying to prove something, and so then they got resistant. And in the end, you know, the film works as intended, although it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. Again, all these different framings of what's expected.
Yeah, well, and so, you know, sometimes Wikipedia obviously isn't all that, it's not all correct. However, it does say right now, tell me if this is true or not. It says that you're currently, like, it's under, like, future projects. It says that you're working on something called Story of Pain. Is that correct?
That's this movie. That's what it was called.
Oh, okay. So it's the same thing. They're saying it's a future project, but all the rage, it's the same thing.
I have nothing to do with that. I'm not a Wikipedia person, so I can't change it or anything.
Yeah. 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 So. Well, I mean, I know that there's definitely been there. I mean, this, it's going way deeper than what we're talking about, but I know that the original Wikipedia page on the, for instance, like the Malaysian Airlines flight that got lost 4 years ago, which is probably of all news stories, the one I've been most obsessed with in my entire life. It's like, I'm still looking probably twice a week for new, you know, what's new in this story. But I remember, like, before anything even went public, there was, you know, a Wikipedia page had said, like, hijackers got this, or it was assisted suicide, or like something like that. One of the dangers of having something that's open source like that. What are you working on now? What's coming out in the future?
Well, we have a film. We're working on trying to get all of our stuff online. We have like 10 films, and so, you know, we own them all, which is nice. But it's a lot of work to try and get them out. But we're also working on a film that was almost combined with All the Rage, and it's about nature versus nurture, and a lot about how we become who we are. You know, I grew up in a time in which Free to Be You and Me was on everybody's turntable. And my parents were, you know, both in that kind of world of mind, you know, dealing with social and mind issues. And so I didn't really, I thought everything was nurture and not nature. And then I had the two kids and it was like, oh, that's wrong.
Yeah. No kidding.
You come out who they are and you're not going to shape them into what you want. And if you try to, you're just going to screw them up.
Yep.
And so that was kind of the impetus for that. And so it's like a lot about donor conception and adoption. And there's a bunch of characters. And it's all shot. It's been shot since 2006. So that's where we almost combined the two movies at one point because they were so connected.
Right. So that, but that's going to be a separate project then.
That's a separate project that we have it all shot. And we're just starting to edit.
Finally. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. And where can people find you online? Give me the run sheet.
RUMUR.com is the warehouse for all of it. That's our company. Rumor.com. It's a palindrome. Like the R's face each other. And then you've got the U and then the M in the middle. It's a beautiful little thing. And yeah, so we have a bunch of our films are up there and a lot of my photography and some of the music stuff. So that's the best place. That'll be the way to kind of find everything. We also have like an All the Rage Facebook page, and we have, you know, a Rumor page. And we have another film that we're traveling with right now called Working in Protest that's compiled from 30 years of protest work that we've done. So,
awesome.
Yeah, we do cool. A lot.
All right, Michael, this was great. Thank you so much. I'm glad. I think that we've been talking about doing this for 9 months now, so it's good to finally get it done. I appreciate your time, man.